problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Hear me.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyer's Bridge Show. I'm your host, Jim Laffey, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. Good afternoon, Maria.
Good afternoon, Jim.
How are you doing? All right, I trust?
Yes, I am doing fine.
Well, let our listeners know what's in store for them if they stay tuned today.
All right. Well, I hope all of you listeners will stay tuned. Today on the Lawyers Guild Show, we'll hear from voices challenging the Trump administration's brutal might makes right approach. Our first guest, Jeff Mackler, will examine the foreign policy consequences of this agenda, with a particular focus on the U.S. attacks on Venezuela, as well as talking about Cuba. Then, after the break, we'll speak with Guillermo Torres of CLUE about faith leaders of all denominations who are on the front lines of the struggle for immigrant justice and calling for human dignity.
All right. Sounds like a good show. I hope our people do stay listening. Why don't you introduce that first topic and we'll get right into it.
All right. Well, just days into the new year, if we all recall, in the early morning hours of January 3rd, the Trump administration launched a brutal attack on Venezuela. According to reports, the assault left at least 80 people dead, including 32 Cuban soldiers, and resulted in the U.S. capturing Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. The U.S. plans to prosecute them in federal court in Lower Manhattan, claiming they are drug traffickers. The following morning, Trump and his so-called Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, boasted about taking control of Venezuela, making lots of money, reclaiming what they called their oil, and turning it over to multinational corporations like ExxonMobil. This is precisely the kind of action that the United Nations was created to prevent in the aftermath of World War II. Aggressive war was outlawed. Here at home, Congress passed the War Powers Act more than 50 years ago to stop secret military aggression and to require congressional approval before launching attacks on other nations, approval that was neither sought nor obtained in this case. And then across the U.S., protests quickly erupted. People took to the streets, remembering how the war in Iraq was sold to the public with claims about weapons of mass destruction, claims that later proved to be false. Joining us today is Jeff Mackler. Jeff is the National Secretary of Socialist Action and was the party's candidate for U.S. President in both 2016 and 2020. He also serves on the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Jeff is the author of more than 20 books and pamphlets, including CIA Crack in America, which documents the U.S. government's role, through figures like Oliver North, in trafficking crack cocaine from the Colombian Medellin cartel into Los Angeles to illegally fund the Nicaraguan Contras. Jeff Mackler, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Glad to be with you folks.
Thank you. Well, you know, the Trump administration claims its actions in Venezuela was, quote unquote, law enforcement rather than an act of war. How would you describe what happened on January 3rd? And of course, also tell us, you know, no matter what we call it, what message did it send to the rest of the world?
Well, what happened on January 3rd, in truth, is what happens everywhere in the world virtually every day. And I say this without exaggerating. The United States has 1,100 military bases in 110 countries around the world. These are set up in order to defend U.S. economic interests, that is, the interests of the less than 1% capitalist elite. So what happened on January 3rd is typical, except it was open and overt. They gave formal excuses. that Maduro, the president of the country, was a drug pusher. In truth, the United States is the biggest drug laundering country on earth. I happened to be on the board of the Christic Institute with Daniel Sheehan and worked with Gary Webb, who wrote about CIA crack cocaine. And that is the United States literally smuggled Medellin cartel crack cocaine into the United States to sell to unwary or young people, blacks in Los Angeles, and raise the money to fund the Nicaraguan Contras illegally. That is, the Nicaraguans made a revolution in 1979, and Congress had passed the Bolin Amendment, which prohibited any aid to regimes like the Salvadoran, dictatorship and the Somoza dictatorship.
Yes. Well, let's stick with this idea of a lack of a declaration of war for a minute, Jeff. There still has not been any, although the U.S. Senate claims it's going to take up today the matter of a modified war resolution of some sort. But what does this lack of a proper resolution affect? How does it really affect the Constitution and the checks and balance system that's supposed to abide in our Constitution?
In my opinion, Jim Lafferty, that doesn't exist. The United States makes war everywhere, regardless of whether or not there's a declaration of war,
Right. Regardless
of whether or not they can scrape up the votes in Congress to say that you have to go to Congress to declare war. The United States didn't declare war when it sent troops into Cuba to overthrow the Cuban government in 1962. It didn't bother to pass any resolutions when it invaded Dominican Republic in 1965. It overthrew the Jacobo Arbenz regime in 1954 and proceeded to support the U.S.-imposed dictator who killed 400,000 Guatemalan, Mayan, indigenous people. It did the same thing. It murdered 4 million people in Vietnam because of the so-called Tonkin Bay resolution. It declared, it supported the Batista regime, the El Salvadoran dictatorship. It overthrew the Maurice Bishop government in Grenada. It supported the Pinochet dictatorship that slaughtered 60,000 people in Chile, all in the interests of U.S. corporations, Anacondo, Copper, and so on. In Cuba's case, it was the United Fruit Corporation, and the CIA director and secretary of state were John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. They were there to protect U.S. corporate interests. So the idea that some kind of motion from Congress or a U.N. Resolution or the U.N. Charter stops the United States from doing anything is nonsensical.
Mm-hmm. So asking about or following up on something you said, that the one of the differences is that this was so overt. Can you talk about, international law or international relations? What does the UN Charter say about aggressive war? But then what does this also say to the rest of the world about what the U.S. is, what the Trump administration is willing to do? What's your analysis of all of that?
Well, formally, the UN Charter says that poor and oppressed nations have the right to self-determination. But the UN Charter and the UN was established in 1945 at the end of World War II. That war took the lives of some 80 million people. And at the time, it was, in my view, a colonial war for the redivision of the world. So, for example, despite the talk about the UN Charter defending the right of poor and oppressed nations to self-determination, that charter did nothing to end the British control, the Portuguese, the Spanish control of Africa. Their colonies remained intact. There was no freedom granted to them. That is, the same pre-war division of Africa, Latin America, Asia, the Middle East existed with the United Nations. In truth, as far as I know, the United Nations declared war three times, and they did that, and there might have been more, but they did that because they got a unanimous vote of the Security Council, which is what is required. One single vote from any member of the Security Council can stop a UN war. So, for example, the United States went to war in Korea and murdered 1 million Korean people because it had the vote of the Soviet Union for that. And the same thing with Libya. The United States slaughtered and destroyed the infrastructure of that country, claiming that the regime there was about to slaughter people in the East, which turned out to be a fraud. And finally, the United Nations just passed a heinous resolution with the votes, abstentions of Russia and China on Palestine, basically denying the Palestinian people their right to self-determination and allowing the genocide to continue.
Now you've mentioned Cuba, and indeed Venezuela has long supported Cuba. So talk to us, if you will, about the relationship between those two countries and how these recent events might affect Cuba's sovereignty, indeed its survivability.
Well, I want to go back a little bit to the Obama administration. The Obama administration had us, with the support of the Pope, who was visiting Cuba, and Fidel, they had a bit of a cooling off period. And it included the United States agreeing to free the framed up Cuban Five, who had infiltrated CIA organizations. But at that time, a special event took place. The Cuban leadership handed the United States government a list of some 37 assassination attempts against Fidel Castro, orchestrated by the CIA. Castro basically never lived in the same house more than a day or two. And Obama obligingly sent it to the CIA to check out what the 37 or so assassination attempts were. And Obama reported back, well, we can only confirm 27. And that is, the United States could confirm 27 times they tried to assassinate the president of Cuba, not to mention sending troops to invade Cuba. They thought they would literally walk in 1961 or so and declare that they had established a government, call on UN troops and take over Cuba. Fidel himself was part of that battle. He hopped in a tank and defeated and captured the entire U.S.-backed army that was funded in the Dominican Republic. And they captured that army, and they ended up trading it. They gave the captured 1,100, 1,500 soldiers back and returned. The United States agreed to inoculate the entire Cuban population against diseases like polio and typhus and so on. So the fact that the United States intervenes against Cuba and wants to overthrow Cuba is obvious. Today, because the Cubans made a revolution that nationalized U.S. corporations, and by the way, Fidel was quite adamant on this. He said, we didn't nationalize them without compensation. We went to the U.S. corporate books to see what taxes they were paying on their corporation. And of course, they were understating qualitatively. So the Fidel government paid off the United States for all the industries that they nationalized based on the UN figures. It's the same thing with Nicaragua and Venezuela. The United States literally says to the Maduro government, either you give us the oil or we'll give you the Cuban treatment. We'll embargo you, we'll blockade you, we'll invade you, we'll cut you off from world financing institutions, and either you play our game. By the way, I must add that the United States does the exact same thing today with every country in the world. It goes to Vietnam or China or you name the country and says, either you give us a break on control of your resources or we're going to put tariffs on the main products that come into the country. And every country on earth who doesn't want to have 50% a hike in the cost of their products in the United States has to make concessions. Trump is the, quote, deal maker. He sits there with the heads of state, friendly or opposing government, and says, we want your oil, we want your resources, we want your we want you to do ABC, otherwise it's going to cost you hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. That's the policy of the United States.
And I do have a question about the media, but following up on that, what is your opinion about how sustainable that those tactics are?
The United States is a country in deep economic crisis. It's being faced by competition from China that is unprecedented. But it was the United States that allowed China to come into the World Trade Organization, from which they were banned. Basically, profit rates in the United States were down dramatically, and the United States said we need to raise the profits by offshoring U.S. industries to low-wage countries like China. Why the heck should we pay union wages to auto and steel workers and Apple computer type workers when we can have, and listen carefully, Chinese teenage dormitory factory women working 8-hour weeks for 6 cents an hour? So the United States shifted production of major industries offshore to low-wage countries. China was just one of them, and the Chinese government gladly said, sure, send them over. We won't even charge taxes on these corporations. So the United States was making billions of dollars by offshoring industries, not only to China, but to Vietnam and to elsewhere. It's the same thing, in my opinion, with Ukraine. Ukraine was sitting on what the United States wanted, a massive oil resource. So it orchestrated a coup some 12, 14 years ago, overthrew the government that was elected in Ukraine, sent troops to the eastern Ukraine to slaughter the Russian-speaking population, and proceeded, not long after, to bomb the heck out of the pipelines that connected Ukraine to Europe, because the United, that is to England and Germany in particular. Basically, the United States orchestrated the Ukraine war by blowing up the pipelines and substituting American oil, dirty oil, for the Russian gas that had been historically shipped to Germany and had taken U.S. markets. So every war that the United States does, from Nicaragua, it basically said to the Sandinistas, if you take the Cuban road, we're going to invade, embargo, and otherwise punish you. And it says the same thing to the Venezuelans and the Cubans again and again. And in truth, and truth is the only serious answer, every one of these governments has to make concessions or die. The Venezuelans have lost 8 million people, a third of the population, due to the United States starvation, embargo, and blockade, and assassination, and blowing up its refineries. And it basically sits there with people like Trump or his Secretary of State or whatever, and they sit there and they say, either you do this or we starve you to death. And hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have starved. The reason they leave is the same reason that immigrants around the world come to the United States. Mm-hmm. The United States steals their resources, takes over their factories, fires their workers, introduces modern technology, and the people have little choice but to try to leave, to escape, and they come to the United States. There are 11, if not 14 million refugees in the United States from Latin America, and we are demonizing them. We don't need them because we can substitute for human labor machines, technology, if not tariffs and other things. So we're dealing with a monstrous government. You know, when I first heard your question, you said, what happened on January 3rd? I mistakenly thought it was January 6th. Because that was the day that the United States, some 2 years ago, mm-hmm. when Trump was president, and I watched it on TV, mm-hmm. when Trump literally try to organize a coup to overthrow the United States government. He organized 50,000 people. The repressive authorities were not there. They were disappeared by Trump. He made phone calls to members of Congress who were meeting to certify the election, saying, don't certify this election. I have proof that it was a fraudulent election. So he tried to overthrow the United States government. He was impeached for it, but he pardoned all of the people who were part of the fascists like Proud Boys and others who marched on Washington. If we organized a peaceful, massive demonstration on Washington that entered the Capitol building, believe me, it wouldn't be so peaceful. But when his 50,000 people stormed the Capitol building, killed some people, beat the hell out of the few cops that were there to protect it, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. It took some 4 or 5 hours for the police to arrive because the president wanted to organize a coup to take over the government. He had the legislature, he thought, in his pocket. He could bribe a couple of congresspeople. He had the Supreme Court, and he had a handful, hundreds of statements from various judges around the country saying that the vote count had been rigged against him. So he was prepared for the coup, and he is preparing for the same. Whether or not we will have a coup in the United States with the likes of Trump in power depends on us and not on some law that gives Congress the right to declare war or to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Trump has demonstrated that the U.S. Constitution isn't worth a nickel. The Supreme Court has basically ruled in his favor some 95% of the time, no matter what the law was. Just revoking all of the progressive legislation. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm 85 going on 86. And when I was a youngster, the enemy was the House Un-American Activities Committee. I was the chair of the Buffalo Committee to Abolish HUAC, and I was a member of the Socialist Workers Party. Mm-hmm. At that time, during the McCarthy era, we filed the suit against the United States saying we have the democratic right to be a political party. Mm-hmm. We haven't broken any laws. And we spent 10 years in court. And when we finally appeared before the federal district judge, Thomas Grisa, at the end of a battle that we had amassed thousands of people supporting our democratic rights, Judge Grisa asked the government of the United States, who admitted that they had sent 1,100 spies into our party, the Socialist Workers Party. And he said, after decades of spying and 1,100 spies, have you ever found this party to have committed a single illegal act? And Judge Grisa said, no. So he ordered the United States government to give us the names of the spies and withdraw all of them from the party. Well, we negotiated a deal with that, and basically the United States had to say, we're not spying anymore. But today, Maria, do you know how many people have national security agent clearance in the United States that spy on the American people via its 15 agencies? 5 million people.
Wow.
They spy on everyone. They can read everyone's email. They can put all of us away. And the only thing that stops them is the kind of mass movement we built during the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and the struggle against the Vietnam War, when we won a majority of the people to say out now. And that's what we want to do in the United States. Mm-hmm. U.S. hands off Venezuela. Out now. No to the sanctions. No to a military budget that exceeds the total. The real military expenditure is over $2 trillion that exceeds the total of the entire world combined. That's the problem that we are facing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to give Jim a chance. I was hogging up our questions, but Jim, and we are running out of time. We still have a few more minutes, but Jim, do you want to take the last
Well, let me, no, let, it, it doesn't matter, but let me, yeah, ask a couple of the questions you and I talked about wanting to ask.
Yeah.
We will skip over some of the questions about the Democratic Party and the, how the mainstream media is covering it, although Jeff, feel free to comment on that. But how have people, currently, you mentioned how in the past with the out now movement around Vietnam and so forth, masses of people in the streets, how it's the people that save us and not the government and the laws thereof. How have people been pushing back against the administration's makes right approach now? Is it sufficient? What does your organization think? What do we have planned for the future? Just a bit about that before we have to let you go.
Thanks so much. We have a giant contradiction, in my opinion, today. Every poll shows the majority of the American people are against the U.S. genocide in Palestine. They're against the war in Venezuela. They're against massive military spending. In fact, the plurality of the people support socialism, however abstract that is, as opposed to capitalism. That's according to the polls, polls like the Pew polls, New York Times Associated Pew polls. But the contradiction is that despite the opinion, the ability to bring those people into the streets is still limited. Our organization, Socialist Action, believes that real change comes from exposing the contradiction between what the government says and what the people want, but exposing it by unprecedented massive mobilizations. Everybody in the world in my generation said that no one could defeat the U.S.-imposed, CIA-imposed Shah of Iran. They had the largest military apparatus and they had the largest number of political prisoners in the world. And the United States installed the Shah in a coup that it orchestrated in 1953. The Iranians had a demonstration in Tehran that had 7 million people. The army disintegrated. That's virtually what happened in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
We mobilized so many people, millions of people on both coasts.
Yes.
Jim, you were a part of that.
Oh, yes.
But the United States government had to back off. The Supreme Court itself went from the Frankfurter document, which allowed them to persecute people on the grounds that communists represented a national security threat to the United States, to a reversion to the First Amendment that said you had the right to free speech, free association. I was arrested during the civil rights movement 9 different times. My party was subjected to having 1,100 agents in it. The Hollywood 10 went to jail because of their beliefs. Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party, was the norm for the McCarthyite witch hunt. That was virtually disappeared, and along with it, almost all of the legislation that, quote, legalized the witch hunt. We can win if we win the majority of the American people. Mm-hmm. That's what Socialist Action is all about.
Excellent.
We want the majority of the people to rule in their own name and their own interests, as opposed to the wealth of the country being owned and controlled by 0.1%, the super elite rich. They're the ones that own the copper in Chile. They're the ones that want Venezuelan oil, the number one in the country. They want Iranian oil and Libyan oil and Syrian oil and Ukrainian oil. We want a world that lives in peace with each other, where the wealth of the nation is shared and everyone prospers and U.S. withdraws its troops everywhere in the world. We don't want to be the cop of the world. So we want people to join our party. Join it in mobilizing millions in the streets that demonstrates the contradiction between the ruling rich and their 0.1% who own the wealth and the needs of the American people. They want health care. They want child care. I want to say one more thing. It is not unusual that the United States and the Trump administration sent Maduro, who we demand his freedom, and his wife, Celia Flores, to New York City, where Mamdani was elected the mayor of the country in an unprecedented large vote. If I were Mamdani, I would accede to the demands of the American people. I would organize massive peaceful demonstrations demanding his freedom, demanding that the Trump administration not use New York City in order to carry out its foreign policy. This sheer idea that the head of state, the democratically elected Maduro government, who has been framed up a million times over, the guy didn't do anything other than to try to set up a series of missions that empowered the Venezuelan people. Yes, I and others have criticism of Mamdani, but they are subordinate to our support to the right of the Venezuelan people and all other oppressed nations to freedom, to self-determination, not to be ruled by the rich.
Jeff, before we have to let you go, though, give us the website for your party and how people can get more information about what you've been now discussing.
Great. Feel free to call us at socialistaction.org. Our phone number is there. You can join us. But most important, get involved in the struggle. Get involved in the streets. Unify. In my generation, we used to say we are for massive, united front, democratic, organized coalitions to mobilize the majority to win freedom in this country. I have the same view now that I had 20, 30, 50, 60 years ago. U.S. out now, hands off, self-determination for Venezuela, no war against Cuba, not to mention all the other nations in the earth yes. where the United States has troops. Thank you so much for allowing me on your show again.
Oh, Jeff Mackler, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on our show. We appreciate it very much. We're now going to have a brief station identification, folks. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with another important topic for your consideration.
Hi, I'm Ashley Judd, and I believe that when we listen collectively, change happens. And I believe we should listen to girls and women. I believe that girls and women should speak for themselves, with and for each other, about their bodies, their rights, and their dreams. That's why I think woman-made media is so important, and why we all need to tune in to Feminist Magazine on KPFK.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to radio powered by the people, KPFK 90.7 FM.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
All right. Well, welcome back. We are here with the National Lawyers Guild show, Lawyers Guild radio show. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty, who I'm glad is back today. He had a little time off. And Jim, right now we're going to talk to Guillermo Torres, although just for our listeners, I did pre-record this because he is actually at a retreat today. So let's go ahead and roll that tape. Across the country, some of the most visible advocates for immigrant rights aren't politicians or lawyers. They're people of faith. Pastors, rabbis, imams, and lay leaders are showing up at places of worship, city hall, and in the streets protesting, insisting that how we treat immigrants is a moral issue, not just a political one. Many faith traditions are rooted in respecting the dignity of every human being. Many traditions teach us to be hospitable to strangers and that we have a duty to stand with those who are most vulnerable. For these communities, immigration advocacy isn't about partisanship. It's about living an authentic life according to one's own beliefs and conscience. Today, I'm joined by Guillermo Torres, the Immigration Director at Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, or CLU. Guillermo leads CLU's immigration and outreach campaigns and has organized successful living wage and worker justice efforts from Long Beach to LAX. former Teamster and longtime immigrant rights activist, Guillermo grounds his organizing in faith, one he returned to as an adult and now sees as central to healing injustice and suffering in our communities. Guillermo Torres, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here with you and with the community.
Well, thank you. Well, let's start off with, for listeners who aren't familiar with CLUE's work, give us a little background. When was it formed? What is its mission? And who are its members and coalition partners?
Well, our organization was founded in 1996 by Dr. Reverend Jane Slauson, who was a chief strategist for Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolence philosophy and theology. So Reverend Lawson, who was a beautiful human being, a beautiful soul, an amazing faith leader, he's one of our founders, also Rabbi Bierman, and then an Episcopalian, either priest or lay leader, George Rigas. All three of them have gone. Dr. Reverend James Lawson was the last one that left us, sadly, about a year or 2 years ago. And it was founded in 1996 to walk alongside with workers around economic justice. The first action, I think it was around the hotels in Beverly Hills. I think Maria Elena Durazo, who is another beautiful human being and a very amazing leader, she was there, I think, also at the beginning of the foundation of our organization. And they were doing this big action in Beverly Hills to stand for, they organized all these religious leaders. I think it was like 200 religious leaders to walk of different faith traditions to walk with the hotel workers to demand a living wage, to demand a respect at work at the hotels in Beverly Hills. And from that action, I think that was the birth of the idea that I think Maria Elena Durazo said, well, why don't we put together an organization that organizes faith leaders? And I think Maria Elena Durazo was part of that. I think Lane was also part of that at the forefront of founding our organization. It's composed it's probably the biggest interfaith organization in Los Angeles. It is composed of religious leaders of different traditions. It also it's not only clergy or ministers, but it's also lay leaders. Also, for a while now, that CLUE's been at the forefront of immigration advocacy and intimate solidarity with immigrants, in addition to workers who are fighting for economic justice and dignity. We're also part of the larger movement for. That falls in line with our values around economic justice, like Unite Here, SEIU, some of the SEI unions like 721, USCW, and other labor partners like the Teamsters. We've done campaigns with the Teamsters together with Lane and partnership with Lane around truck drivers, around healthcare workers, organizations like INDEF, CHIRLA, CARESEN, KINE, Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project, the Filipino Worker Center, and many, many, many other orgs that have that CLUE has collaborated and supported in pursuing and walking. Our mission is to educate, organize, and mobilize religious leaders to walk in intimate solidarity with immigrants, with workers, and people of color communities that are vulnerable and are oppressed. We don't organize a clergy to speak for the workers or to speak for the immigrants, but it's to speak along beside them, to help them amplify. Because we are led by the communities, they're not led by us. We are led by the communities. Their voices are the most important voice in the cry for justice and for dignity and humanity.
Last Friday, CLUE helped coordinate an emergency vigil in Santa Ana calling for an end to ICE murders. This, of course, was on the heels of several shootings by ICE last week, including the shots that killed Renee Nicole Good last Wednesday. Now, I know CLUE holds weekly vigils in Los Angeles that are related to immigration anyway, but I think this last Friday's vigil was different, was it not? And tell us about the two different kinds of vigils.
The main one was Thursday in front of the federal building in Los Angeles. It was in response to the horrific murder of Renee Nicole Good, a mother, a woman, painful and unjustifiable. How can you shoot a mother point blank in the head like that? How can you do that and justify it? And then for the government officials who keep lying to the American community, the American public, to dehumanize her and try to associate her with terrorism how shameful and how disgraceful it is that this administration, but this is not the first time they do that. Every time they try to justify their cruelty, their evil, all this spearheaded by a person by the name of Stephen Miller, who has a really dark soul. And I don't know, see how the Republican Party is associated with such a person that has a dark soul. But this was in response to the killing of this, you know, it really hit me hard. And when I heard the news, I had just came out of Adelanto Detention Center visiting immigrants in that space, which is a very horrific space, and where immigrants died and continue to die there. And had just attended a hearing, thankfully, of a committee member that we were able to help get a bond granted. And then that's when I saw the news of the murder of Renee Nicole Good. We started organizing to bring people of our faith communities together, but also to bring the community together. The LA Rapid Response, which has consists of many, many organizations that we're part of, which has played a major role in responding to the horrific raids starting back in June. We had to call out the administration, the state sanctioned violence against a human being. So yeah, so we organized. We had about 300 people, I think it was. It was a very powerful witness. It's very important for us to be a witness of what's happening today, and to call, and as religious communities, to make sure that we're calling out and exposing the lies of this administration to justify their cruelty against the immigrants, and now the murder of a mother. So we had many faith leaders there. It was well attended by the media. I think we had about 25 media channels. For us, it was very important to not only to honor her memory and to honor her life, but also to denounce the killing by ICE. Also, the other important point here is that this administration keeps blaming the left and the radicals. No, it's not the radical or the left that this is happening. It's because of your cruelty, policies of immigration, your agents breaking the law, ICE, Department of Homeland Security, and Border Patrol, breaking the law and violating the rights of immigrants and community members, including U.S. citizens, permanent resident holders. I was not surprised that this happened, because that's the way this administration has been, you know, operating. And it was just a matter of time. And I mean, before the horrific murder of Renee Nicole Good, you know, we had a Mexican national killed in Chicago. We had immigrants dying in Adelanto about 6 months ago, a Mexican national that died. And who knows if that whole true story came out of why he died inside that Adelanto, because that place has a horrific history of medical negligence. You know, I worked with many immigrants in Adelanto who used to tell me the horrific medical attention when they were sick. Vigil was different this time because we have our crew, religious women, they call themselves the godmothers of the disappeared, who have been highlighting since back in June the kidnapping of our committee members, being sent to clandestine prisons, secret prisons, being disappeared from the system, but their due process being violated. That's what the godmothers of the disappeared highlight every Tuesday. But this time it was with the vigil we did on Thursday, and I think we had a vigil also, the godmother's vigil also happens in Orange County. I think that was on Friday. It brought a more sense of a pain to what we're feeling, what the nation is feeling. Very hard to process the shooting point blank of a woman, of a mother. In that sense, the vigil was more an expression of the rage and of the anger, of righteous anger, and the denouncing of the killing by ICE, and then the denouncing of this administration's lies, keep trying to justify everything that they do to justify all the breaking of the law that they continue to do, you know, in the community.
If people do want to participate in some of the weekly vigils, how can they find out more?
Yeah, so they could go to our website, but every Tuesday at 12 noon, it is organized by religious women, but men are also welcome to support and be there to support also, and families are welcome. It's it's grounded on our justice, compassion, humanity, and speaking truth to power. It's every Tuesday at 12 noon at the federal building in downtown LA, where ICE headquarters are located. It's a very solemn procession. Remembering those who have been kidnapped by ICE and Border Patrol. And so every Tuesday they could join that. But they could go to our website at Crew Justice, so they could join there. And then there's one in Orange County. So, and these vigils, since we started doing them, they started, other faith leaders have started, heard about our vigils, and they actually started organizing their own vigils at, throughout different areas of the country. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that. And if you're just tuning in, I'm Maria Hall here with Guillermo Torres from Clue. And we are on KPFK, the Lawyers Guild show, of course. Guillermo, also last weekend, I know Clue helped coordinate at least one of the nationwide ICE Out for Good protests in downtown Los Angeles. And at a time when many people are afraid to speak out right now, there's a lot of intimidation in the air. Why is it, in your opinion, so important to you and to Clue to show up and speak out at public events like these, even though there might be a risk of retaliation?
Well, you know, we've been out there with the at the front lines. You know, when the race started, we were facing off with the National Guard, with the LAPD, with the ICE, our religious leaders were at the front lines, but not before the community. The community was out there. That was a powerful witness. To see in the news scripts and to see in the social media, mothers, children confronting the cruelty and inhumanity of ICE, that was really like for me, just having that, seeing that and just seeing that, I go, you know what? We got to be out there. Religious communities got to be out there. You know, they were out there first, you know, the community. And so we said, we got to be at the front lines also. We got to denounce this this policy. We got to denounce this attack on our community. We got to try to offer a safe space for our community. And then with the arrogance that they do it, like, you know, with the arrogance that they, you know, like in, during the Christmas season, they came out with a Jingle Bell song and Santa dressed as ICE. Like, how could you be so cruel and so inconsiderate and so inhumane that you make fun of what you're doing to all these families and the separation of mothers and children, fathers from their children? How can you be so cruel? But this is what we're facing, these people, right? We cannot dismiss the fear in, you know, how I might be feeling or somebody else might be feeling, even though we're religious leaders. But nevertheless, when I think of the pain and the pain of an immigrant community member that just been snatched from his family, when I think of our children seeing crying while they're taking away their parents, when you think of the immigrants that are in the horrific detention facilities, prisons that are, where there's so much mental cruelty and suffering and pain and so isolated, I have to be out there. I have to be there. I have to be there. I have to be, I cannot be indifference to their suffering. I must be there. And I must be in that space. And I must hold space, and we must hold space out there in light of the threats, in light that they shot some pastors with pepper, you know, sprays in the head in Chicago and stuff like that, in light that they might use their batons at us or tear gas. Some of our pastors were tear gassed by the sheriffs doing the Home Depot raid back in June over here in LA. In spite of that, you know what? That does not compare, you know, what I might suffer or what might I be subject to because of this administration. That does not compare at all, and not even a little bit, to the suffering of an immigrant that's been directly impacted by the cruelty. I must not be indifferent to the suffering of another human being, because I am connected to every human being in this world. We are connected as human beings, no matter what country, no matter what faith, whether you have faith or you don't have faith, no matter what gender, their humanity is connected to us. You know, that's why, for example, we did an event on Thanksgiving Day at the federal building, because how can we say thank you at this moment? How can we celebrate Thanksgiving or grace? Not that I don't want to take away from people who did. I'm just saying what I was feeling. But it was very difficult for me to process Thanksgiving this year, and that we had to be there and be at that federal building where the immigrants are locked up right there by Aliso and Alameda, and let them know that we haven't forgot about them, that our voices. And that's what is very important for our voices to continue to be heard. It's very important for us to be present in that space of suffering, because whether it's in detention, whether it's on the streets, whether it's in jobs or in churches, for us to be there with our community, to be in that space, to be present, is very important because we want to be in that solidarity. We want to make sure that they know that they're not by themselves. We want to make sure that we will try to do the best we can to protect them, to be with them, to stand with them, and to let them know that they are not by themselves. Mm-hmm. It's very important to continue to be present publicly, denouncing this administration, publicly educating the American public that's not familiar with the lie, that is being bombarded with lies by this administration. And like I say, everything, all of this is traced back to a person by the name of Stephen Miller, who's evil and who has a dark soul, and how the Republican and this administration is associated with that. Mm-hmm. And then it's also really evil when they try to associate, if you're a person of faith, especially the Christian tradition, mm-hmm. When they try to associate the gospel and Jesus or God with such cruelty, you know, they don't have a right to claim the name of God. They don't have a right to claim the name of Jesus, especially when they're associating it with such cruelty. Because the greatest commandment in the Christian tradition, my tradition, is to love your neighbor as yourself. And that means that I will never turn my back on another human being. It's disgraceful that a person like Franklin Graham comes out and defends this administration and associates God with that administration. Are you kidding me? Everything that that administration does is against the gospel. It's against what Jesus stood for, the most vulnerable. Just the commandment itself, the greatest commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. Why will you turn your back on your neighbor, on another human being, and how God has a special care for the immigrant, a special care for the immigrant, mm-hmm. the orphan, the widow, and the immigrant. So, you know, it's very important in light of the threats and in light of the cruelty of this administration, it's very important for us to continue to be present, publicly speaking truth to power. It's very important for us to be there as compassionate and empathy with the immigrants in light of everything that's happening, because in the past, evil has been manifested in many different ways throughout, you know, the world history. And when we stood quiet, when people did not speak up, when people turned their back or turned a blind eye and let that happen because nobody spoke up, we saw how horrific that evil was. Mm-hmm. So we must be present, because we must not repeat the past mistake of human beings being so indifferent to the suffering of other people. So we must speak up and we must be present. Present is the important word. Mm-hmm. In the spaces of suffering, in the spaces of cry for justice, in the face of liberation, in the face against this administration who, you know, has these horrific policies. And now the American people are starting to see that, and especially in light of this mother that was shot point blank, a mother, you shoot a woman and a mother point blank right in the face, and then you lie about it, and the American people are seeing the videos, and the video is really showing what really happened, and that's why there's so much anger, there's so much anger, there's so much people coming out to the streets and blasting this administration for their for not only for their lies and their deceit, but also for their inhumanity and their cruelty.
Well, Guillermo Torres, as a faith leader yourself, I imagine people confide in you about their fears, about their anger, really strong emotions. If there are listeners who are feeling those things and really looking for solace, what advice do you have for them, and how does the community and organizing help with that?
Well, you know what? I think everybody in what, you know, when I'm processing pain, fear, you know, sometimes doubt, you know, what helps me is being with communities that share the values that we share, the values of justice, compassion, humanity, the values of lifting the humanity of every human being, no matter where they come from, no matter, you know, what gender, what tradition. So being in community with, you know, in spaces where you feel welcome, where you feel heard, where you're visible, I think being part of those communities, so that might be through faith communities, right, that are that are real, for real, because not all faith communities are real. Not all faith communities stand with the community. Not all faith communities speak up. Not all, and religious people should be right now at the forefront of this. They should be at the forefront of this. More religious people should be at the forefront of this poverty. But look to be with community in, you don't have to have a faith tradition. You look for those traditions of faith communities that are, that welcome everybody, that welcome all genders, that don't exclude, don't judge, and they welcome every human, every person, whether you have faith or not. There are many faith communities like that. Crew has a big network of that. Most of our faith leaders and lay leaders are you know, in that community. So look to the community, join Crew, join others like in community like Chile, La Cares, and the Rapid Response Network. When they do events, come together, feel, because you want to be in a space that you feel welcome. You want to be in a space that there's community, there's relationships, there's genuine relationships, not fake relationships, but genuine relationships. So be part of the community. Look for organizations that will support and walk, are walking with immigrants at this time. There's many of them, from, like I mentioned, some of them already, but even in the Asian community, we work with some of our Asian partners, the Asian American Advancing Justice, or other APALA, or Filipino Migrant Center, Filipino Worker Center. We're walking right now with a Filipino lady that was just impacted. Her husband was just deported to Turkey, and now we're trying to help her and support her, offer her community mutual support. But so be with community. Don't be alone. Try, if you're alone and if your family is impacted by this, know that there are people there who want to walk with you. We have religious leaders accompanying immigrants to courts. We have them accompanying them to check-ins. We provide that spiritual care, that support, not to convert, not to preach or anything, just to have a presence there. So if you're scared, that's, if you're have a lot of fear, if you have a lot of pain, a lot of stress, you know, reach out and do communities that share your values, and don't process everything by yourself. You know, there's people that can help you process that, to try to be in that space with you, not to feel what you feel, but to process it, and just for you to be there, just like this Filipino lady that we're helping, that her husband was horrifically abused by the ICE system, and the way they detained him, she felt so alone. And then we work with the Inland Coalition for Immigrant Justice. We've been doing a lot of work around detention, IC and Crew, for a long time. And then we have IC reached out to one of our Asian partners that works for Filipino community members. And now she's found a community. Now she had expressed she felt so alone, especially during the holidays and things like that. And I was supporting her for the last 2 weeks during the during the detention of her husband. So reach out to communities of faith, reach out to community organizations, nonprofits that share your values, reach out to counselors, reach out to mental health providers. If you're feeling really a lot of anxiety, stress, but just know that you're not by yourself, and try to be in the spaces where church spaces, congregations like I told you that are, open and very, and share our values. They're very welcoming. And also the, singing, the music, the prayers, even if you're not a person of faith, there's many different traditions. Some are welcome all traditions into their spaces. That's a place where you might find, some care for your soul, for your mind, some accompaniment, some relationship. So that's what I will tell the community who at this time and might be experiencing a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. Go find spaces that are welcoming, and that could help you walk along with you, not for you, but with you in that time of difficulty. But also, reach out to professionals too. Know that you're not by yourself. Yeah.
Well, Guillermo, we are running out of time, but I did just want to ask you one last question. I know you've been working on some bond activities. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we launched our bond fund back in June with in partnership with MDEF. It's a bond fund that we used to have back in 2016. And because of that bond fund, because of people helping donate to the bond fund, because of they want to help our community, we have been able in the last few months been able to pay about 90 bonds of people that were in detention.